Hi, my name is Jim Lewis.
And my name is Chris Painter.
Welcome to season two of Inside Cyber Diplomacy, a casual and we hope revealing conversation with Jim and I and our guest of the week that hopes to go behind the scenes and really tell the story of what's going on.
Thanks for joining us. Today's guest is Will Middleton, Cyber Director, Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office of the United Kingdom. Will has extensive diplomatic experience and will talk to us about the direction that UK policy is going to take, how it will cooperate with other countries, next steps in the UN, and then the links between cyber and development. So a good session, Will. What's top of your mind when it comes to thinking about cyber diplomacy? What's your agenda look like these days?
It's a good question. Well, I think the first thing I'd say is it's nice to see cyber diplomacy at the top of the agenda. My favorite story is that 2016 cybersecurity strategy, as it was then, had international engagement as chapter 14 of 14, which was the afterthought, it seemed like. And even though in many ways it was a really excellent strategy that launched things like the National Cybersecurity Center, it did sort of put the international elements on the margins. And it feels like we've got over that hump. So, you know, the National Cyber Strategy the UK launched last year, one of the four pillars, we love pillars and strategies, one of the four pillars was global leadership. And I think that's heartening to see foreign ministries, diplomats, and the concept of cyber diplomacy now put centrally alongside, you know, some of the more technical aspects of cybersecurity. So that's the big picture, and I think that's quite heartening. Obviously, the thing that's kept me busy for much of this year has been the conflict in Ukraine and the cyber conflict that we are seeing play out and trying to support the Ukrainians to resist and recover, but also to learn what is happening. Because as we've seen in Ukraine over the last 8 years, what happens in Ukraine often comes to our own shores or to our own threats in different ways.
Let's just pick that apart a little bit and start with the cyber diplomacy angle. The UK was pretty quick off the mark. Not too long after my office was established to the State Department, the UK Foreign Office established a position, probably within the first two or three that did around the world. And I was always a little jealous in the beginning. The office you had more people than I did at the time, but—
We're always jealous because it turns out that parliamentary democracy is better. Yeah. So we're used to inventing things here and then seeing other people do them while we're still debating. And so don't take that too seriously.
But, you know, what do you attribute? I mean, what factors do you think really contributed to putting cyber diplomacy more on the front burner than it traditionally has been?
Well, I mean, I think the credit goes back to William Hague, who was our foreign secretary in 2011. And I think he spotted the importance of these issues, the importance of how what we now call cyber power is integrated into our other capabilities and alongside traditional foreign security policy. So our ability to project, promote our interest in cyberspace are just as important as our projecting them in, you know, international politics, in the global economy, through soft power, and obviously through hard power, our military capabilities. So I'd give him a lot of the credit, and it's built from there. You know, a lot of these things are a long time in the making. You know, I definitely stand on the shoulders of my predecessors. We just got in there first. We recognized the importance of cyber diplomacy alongside other forms of diplomacy and integrating with domestic capabilities. And we've built it over time. And, you know, now, actually, we're a pretty big department. You know, we have closing on about 50 staff working on these issues, a range of threats, governance and international resilience, which I think puts us amongst some of the largest.
Yeah.
So right. This is allegedly about cyber diplomacy. What are the skills off the top of your head that you would want to tell young cyber diplomats? And this is capacity building. The UN has this Women in Cyberspace program that will happen before the OEW.
Actually, the UK is one of the sponsors of that.
So what did you feel like you needed coming into the job? Now that you've been in it for a while, what do you think would be useful?
So my first lesson to everyone is, it's not that complicated, right? Cyber diplomacy is like any other form of diplomacy. Fundamentally, we're trying to build relationships in order to influence people. That's what foreign ministries do. Now, you need an understanding of the technology that sits behind it, the nature of the threat, or the framework in which you want to govern that technology. But fundamentally, it's about understanding other countries, right? Understanding their incentives, their politics, their interests, and how you build relationships with both the individuals who work for those countries and the broader state. And so the skills we need, the skills that I'm looking for, are, yes, you know, I'm recruiting people from our signals intelligence agency, from some of our domestic departments, Department of Justice or the Home Ministry, from academia, but also from in the Foreign Office, I'm looking for people with multilateral skills, who understand some of those principal threats, so who understand Russia and China, for example, who are, you know, experienced in developing and running programs, and also who are able to kind of build sustained campaigns. So a lot of what we do in cyber diplomacy is for the long term. And we really need that mindset of it's less sort of the quick wins responding to events. It's more about as much about sustaining effort over many years.
I mean, that sort of leads to the issue is, you talked about long-term effects and the issue, you know, a lot of the work that's been done in the UN, for instance, and you've been a part of this, is coming up with rules of the road, which is great. Yeah. But rules of the road don't work very well if there's no accountability for folks that break them. And certainly the Ukraine crisis is invasion is illustrating that. So how do you do that in cyberspace? How do you work with your other countries and even with your own government to try to close that gap a little bit, which is right now pretty yawning?
Yeah. Nobody says the system is perfect, right? Nobody says that, sadly, we have a framework of international law that, you know, is as effective as that of domestic law. And yet, without it, we would be searching for something similar. We all recognize the importance of norms of behavior, and that's because we care about legitimacy. And actually, to a greater or less extent, you know, Russia and China care about legitimacy as much as the UK or the US. The importance of normative behavior is one, we are looking for strategic stability, so a shared agreement of what is acceptable behavior. But also, we want to establish grounds for when states transgress those accepted behaviors to legitimize a response. And, you know, we're in the very early stages of that. But that is ultimately one of the reasons why we care about this framework of international governance of cyberspace. But it's, you know, it cannot work on its own. We need to retain our national capabilities. We need to improve our resilience. We need to develop this concept of cyber deterrence that we've talked about. But, you know, I think our view is that a framework of norms and international law is complementary to all of that.
I was at a meeting this morning with a few people from ASEAN countries, and they feel like they're trapped between two competing blocks. They're drawing closer to conflict. When you say we need to build global support, what's your sort of 50,000 foot take on that when you look at Africa or South America or ASEAN? I mean, what are the places that you feel would benefit most from work? Which are the ones that need a little more persuasion? I left out the Middle East, by the way. We can put that in if you want.
It's a really quite good question. And you're right that most countries do not want to choose sides. And that's been the case for forever. That's not a new phenomenon of the last 10 years. You know, when we talk about this kind of question of choice, we talk about giving countries the choice to make their own decisions. So instead of choosing between one or the other, giving them the kind of the tools and the capabilities to make a sovereign choice. So, you know, when it comes to technologies, for example, we talk about capacity building, giving countries, you know, the choice between which technologies they choose to invest or to incorporate within their infrastructure. And that's the same goes for training or legal frameworks or, you know, choice of the model for, you know, national security, cybersecurity centers. It's fundamentally about giving countries a choice. Now, when it comes to, you know, the competition for the middle ground, we talk about this a lot within the UN. If you look at the kind of the basic voting patterns, there's about a block of about 90 countries that kind of sit in the middle and would rather not pick sides. you know, our challenge is not to force those countries into picking sides, but to try and kind of win the argument in their own interest. That's, I think that's the challenge for us. And that means that sometimes, you know, we need to make it not about us versus them, but about, you know, a shared national or global interest. But that's a tricky one when everybody, as you say, you know, just like you, Jim, people jump to it's, you know, it's China or the US. What's the choice?
Obviously, you mentioned capacity building and you know, you've been a long-term member of the Global Forum on Cyber Expertise, which I help run. But capacity building is the thing that a lot of the countries, when they came to those UN meetings, said they wanted. They were happy to debate these ethereal issues of norms and other things, and they were happy to be part of those discussions. But at base, what they really wanted was help. And so how can we make that better? I mean, one issue that we've talked about is bringing the development community and the cyber community closer together, because they seem to be completely different environments, different camps. Traditionally, we've gotten a little better. Yep. But how can we actually answer that need from those countries, which was recognized even in some of the UN documents?
Political prioritization and resources, number one, right? You've got to situate cyber resilience as fundamental to economic growth. We have to make the argument that countries cannot fulfill their economic potential if they remain vulnerable in cyberspace. That's number one. And that, you know, part of that is digital inclusion. It's about ensuring access to new technology is shared equitably, something the UK has championed all along. So I think, you know, getting the politics right in the first place is really important. So certainly something we've done in our national cyber strategy, we've massively increased the amount of money we're putting into cyber capacity building programs, because we see that as really important. One, for our global development agenda, but also for our national security agenda. We recognize that plenty of, you know, our own domestic resilience rests on the resilience of other countries. And we certainly try and match that in our capacity building programs. So I think that's... getting the politics right and the prioritization right is number one. And then there's second is the architecture. There's just so many players involved in this space, and a combination of new players involved in cyber capacity building and then traditional development players, trying to find a way to bring them together and do that kind of that age old challenge of donor coordination, you know, deconflicting the donors and matching donors to recipients. It's pretty simple, but it's really hard to do it's simple in concept, but hard to do on a global level. I think, you know, getting that architecture right is the second challenge. But I've been making that case within my own system. So as you saw, the G7 partnership for global investment, global infrastructure investment announced this summer. Making sure that part of that is delivering cybersecurity resilience is fundamental, right? Situating the cyber capacity building as part of that global infrastructure investment, I think, is kind of challenge number one.
So Chris and I are pushing a new initiative for the UN. It's called the Program of Inaction. And it probably has more chance of success. But snarky remarks aside, what do you think a reasonable agenda is for the UN, both near term, because the OEWG is floundering? What's a reasonable set of goals? You have the third committee, although I think that's been badly damaged by Ukraine. What's a good agenda for the UN, for the democracies in the UN?
Well, number one, multilateral diplomacy is really hard, right? It's a hard grind, whatever the issue. And if you think you're going to make easy wins and you're going to, just because cyberspace is or cyber technologies are moving at pace, that the multilateral diplomacy is going to move at the same pace is naive. And I think all of us involved in diplomacy need to commit to that kind of the hard yards. We have to have a global inclusive process to tackle these questions. It doesn't mean that just because we say it is it's easy to deliver, but it has to exist. I think it's been compounded by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, right? It makes one of the key players, one of the key sponsors of these initiatives, we would argue it's delegitimized them. They are using offensive cyber against their neighbor. But having said all that, I think, you know, you talked about the program of action. I think a good place to go is implementation of what we've already agreed. When times are tough, showing that the progress you've made to date, and we have made a lot of progress over the last 10 years, not enough, but we have made quite a lot, showing that that can have practical effect, putting that into practice and then learning from that implementation what it actually means in practice, and therefore where you need to go next, where the gaps are. That strikes us as a healthy place to go. Doesn't mean you shouldn't continue to debate how we evolve the norms and how we apply international law in cyberspace. We think that needs to be done as well. But when things are really tough in multilateral diplomacy, focus on delivery.
That's one of the, you know, issues. And I agree with you. You have to make progress multilaterally. You can at the same time make progress in smaller groups, smaller like-minded groups too, obviously. But has, you know, because of the war with Ukraine, I mean, that has geopolitical effects beyond, obviously, the war in Ukraine. For instance, Russia blocked about 30 organizations from participating as multi-stakeholder, you know, members or discussing.
And the Chinese sided with them.
Yeah.
You know, and yes, Ukraine blocked, I think, a couple of Russian organizations. But it did seem like, you know, that is a bit of a shot across the bow of like, we're treating this as any other kind of political engagement, and it really doesn't matter. The substance doesn't matter as much, and we're not going to really make progress in the short term. What's your thoughts on that?
Number one, the UK has been a massive champion of multi-stakeholder participation across the UN system, including in the cyber negotiations, right? We cannot come up with the answer to these questions unless we involve states, industry, and individuals. Everybody has to be part of the solution. And so we fought really hard for that. For that deal, we recognized it was an imperfect deal. And guess what? Russia vetoed 27 organizations, all Western organizations, let's be clear, the same day that Ukraine vetoed 5 Russian organizations. But that was, as far as we're concerned, an extremely cynical move. And I think we just need to be clear that, you know, what it was. They picked every single Western organization and vetoed their participation. That shows that Russia is not interested in the views of states, of individuals or industry, not interested in a multi-stakeholder model. Incidentally, I think we also think, I'm going down that list, it sort of vetoed a couple of African organizations as well. We're not sure why, whether they just got caught up with them, missed, or it was deliberate. But we do need to call that out. And therefore, we do need to find a way to consult those. And frankly, if that involves consulting them outside the process, and going to those organizations and saying, what do you think? Then we'll continue to do that. But as far as we're concerned, we will continue to fight for that multi-stakeholder model, because we don't think you can govern cyberspace through state control alone.
I mean, it's interesting because the program of action is being billed, at least, as a more multi-stakeholder approach. And if this kind of continues, if you have this kind of arrangement, and I'm not saying you would, that certainly lessens the impact of that if the program of action gets off the ground. So that's certainly.
Yeah, and you look, going back to Jim's question about the middle ground, we think, yes, I think a lot of states are frustrated at the lack of progress in the OEWG because of the standoff around stakeholder participation. But at the same time, we also think the vast majority of the UN membership do want to hear the voices of all stakeholders, do believe in multi-stakeholder participation. And we think the Russians are in the minority here. And I think we need to pull them out for what they are.
Yeah, it's very funny. Krutsky, back when the original OEWG launched, I remember made a pitch to me and others that, hey, unlike the GGER process, the OEWG is open and will allow other stakeholders to participate. That actually was the Russian narrative back then. So it's interesting to see how that's developed.
He also said to me at some point, probably in the third meeting, if I had known what they were going to say, I would have let them in. But... let's put that aside. You can't, I think, and you can disagree, I don't think you can have a legitimate process now in the UN unless you involve civil society and the business community, the extent that they'll play. But what is it you'd want to get from them? What is it? What's the signal you'd hope to receive from these groups? Where are they helpful to the process beyond simply bringing it needed legitimacy? I mean, is it what's their contribution? We warned you that this was going to be all over the map, so.
Well, look, I think, number one, they see the world from a different perspective to a bunch of diplomats.
Shocking.
And that is, you know, that's valuable in itself. Number two, the governance of cyberspace is already multi-stakeholder, right? It's already a dispersed kind of model of power, and rightly so, we would say in the UK. So that not only can they be provide the, you know, perspective and answers, but they should be part of the solution as well, implementing that. They are as affected by the behavior of states as any other stakeholders. So you know, our view is it has to become more inclusive. And, you know, yes, that's where we are in the current point of the OEWG, but I think we will continue to return to this in whatever multilateral, bilateral, or small group forum that we work in.
I want to go back to the kind of alliance building, like-minded group building issue you talked about earlier on. You know, obviously there's been a lot of work in NATO around that, and UK is a leading member in NATO. And so, you know, that's obviously good and proceeding. And out of this last NATO meeting, you know, I heard sort of two reactions. One, okay, well, we continue to make progress. Some people said it was revolutionary progress. Some said, you know, we've been doing this for like 10 years now, so since Lisbon, and so this is building on it. What's your sense of that? And then contrast that about whether you've seen any, I guess, roadblocks or issues that have arisen because the UK has now, because of Brexit, is not part of the EU. Has that in any way hindered your ability to partner with your EU colleagues on these issues?
Two quite different questions, Chris. Look, let me take the EU first. The simplest answer is not a lot, actually. You know, I see my European counterparts an awful lot. We fundamentally share the same view of the world. We instinctively want to work together. We have a whole bunch of, you know, mechanisms of cooperation already in place. You know, they haven't yet disinvited me, or maybe not that I'm aware of. But I think inevitably we miss out, maybe a mixed blessing on, you know, those EU coordination meetings. But it doesn't mean that we don't coordinate incredibly closely with the EU. We're at a bit of a hump. We don't have a formal UK-EU cyber dialogue at the moment. We're keen to get that up and running. But I haven't, you know, in all honesty, I haven't seen a big impact beyond the odd barbed comment, or jestful comment, I should say, from our kind of European partners.
Is that because it's seen as a national security member issue and therefore the purview of the member states, or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, partly. You know, it's common security and defense policy is a member state led competence. But I think also, you know, UK's been doing this for a while. We bring quite a lot to the table. We're already pretty active, whether it's on attribution or sanctions. You know, the UK pretty much helped write the EU sanctions model, and then we incorporated ourselves into domestic law when we left the EU. And, you know, our intelligence agencies already got longstanding kind of working relationships. So there's a depth of cooperation that I don't think has been kind of fundamentally damaged. So, you know, I think on the whole, we carry on. And in some ways, it gives us a bit more flexibility. So look at some of the UN negotiations. Absolutely, we coordinate with the EU, as we do with other like-minded. But we don't spend all our time sitting in EU coordination meetings. We spend our time talking to those middle ground that we've talked about, right? Which that is a blessing, if I'm honest. And we always said when we were a member of the EU that we need to spend as much time looking outwards as we do inwards. Well, now we've left, that gives us that opportunity. So, you know, there are upsides. But, you know, the core partnerships we've always had with the US, the Five Eyes community, with the EU and NATO, those are still in pretty good stead.
By the way, that's one of my favorite British phrases, if I'm honest, because I remember when I was a prosecutor telling a judge, "Be honest, Your Honor," and he said, "What are you lying to me the rest of the time?"
There's multiple British phrases which have layers of meaning and disinformation within them.
So are you caught up much in AUKUS and the other various issues out there floating around?
And also go back to NATO at some point.
Yeah, NATO. I wouldn't put it in the revolution. I wouldn't call the strategic concept within the revolutionary camp. I mean, this again, you know, prioritizing the cyber domain within NATO's broader strategy has been something that's been going on for years. I think the recent Madrid summit and the strategic concept just cemented that. I think actually, as NATO, we do have quite a lot of work just to, you know, improve our own resilience, right? We always say cybersecurity starts at home, and that's sort of, I think, priority number one for the alliance. But also these, you know, then pivoting and how we talk about how NATO can integrate cyber into its military capabilities, but then also project power in cyberspace. I think those are the challenges ahead. But I, you know, number one is making sure all allies have similar high levels of cybersecurity.
Let's come back to that one, because I just quickly tell us, are you involved in the AUKUS?
On AUKUS, it's principally about developing shared capabilities. And we've started with the sharing of nuclear submarine capabilities. But we do want to grow it into other areas, including in cyber and advanced technology. And so that's what we're looking at now. We're looking at shared capabilities in cyber and what we should be doing at three that we're not already doing at two or in other small groups.
Mm-hmm. Or at five.
Exactly. Exactly. For us, it has to complement the other groups, not replace them. But I think we're not at the point of announcing anything, but it's certainly the space. We've said publicly that cyber and advanced technologies is something that is on the agenda for cooperation at three.
How about another group that you're in and we're not? The Commonwealth group. What are you guys trying to do with that group? Because that's an interesting collection of countries and you have done cyber with them before.
Yeah, so as you know, we've been chairing the Commonwealth for the last few years before we handed over to Rwanda at the CHOGM this year. And we launched this cyber declaration, which was basically about improving the resilience of all Commonwealth members. And this year we just announced another £15 million program of capacity building across the Commonwealth to do exactly that. Absolutely, right? When we look at which partners we want to work with, the Commonwealth is pretty much top of the list, because that's an established set of relationships. We're already kind of invested in other areas. We already have a lot of cyber capacity building programs in existing Commonwealth members. So that's a natural evolution. What we're looking at now is actually partnering with Commonwealth members in other countries. So we're quite interested about working with, Australia in the Pacific, or within India in the Indo-Pacific, or with sort of African countries across the continent. That's a new theme for us, seeing whether we can kind of partner it sort of bilaterally in a third country.
Yeah, one of the things that was impressive in the last OEWG was the turnout, which was about more than 140 countries. And many of those countries, some of them Commonwealth members from Africa, from Latin America, from ASEAN, had fielded really impressive teams. So I think that's one of the changes between, say, when we started doing this, is there's a lot of countries that take it seriously. But to go back to something you said, when you talk to them individually, I remember a South American diplomat said to me, he said, look, I'm really not ever going to get in a war with my neighbors, right? Tell me about development. So that's the question. Tell me about development and cybersecurity.
Yeah, so we run these programs called digital access programs, right? And we structure them deliberately in sort of three pillars. One is about cybersecurity, one is about economic growth, and one is about digital development. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the offer that we are trying to make to third countries. It's improve your own cybersecurity, it's contribute to your economic development, and it's grow your digital skills and digital inclusion. We have to kind of offer all of those things. If we go back to this, as you asked earlier, Jim, if you go back to this kind of binary, it's us or them, pick sides, it's kind of our model or their model, then I think, we're making a mistake, because that's not what countries want. Fundamentally, all countries want to be more secure and want to look after the economic well-being of their people, right? And if we want to partner with them, that's what the offer needs to look like. So I go back to this point about integration and mainstreaming. We can't talk about cybersecurity or cyber capabilities in isolation. They have to underpin economic growth, digital inclusion, equitable access.
How does that work in your own government? It's always been a uneasy marriage in the US where the sort of the economic people and the cybersecurity and national security people, are different ilk, different language.
At the beginning, somewhat hostile to each other.
Well, yeah, when we did the cyber strategy in 2009, the National Economic Council and National Security Council weren't exactly talking to each other very well. So how is that working for you guys? Because you have very strong agencies doing both things. And as you say, if digitization is the magic word for a lot of developing countries, how can you ingrain and mainstream cybersecurity in that, working with those partners?
Well, the first thing I'd say is we're all on a journey, right? None of us have yet mastered it. 2 years ago, the UK Foreign Office merged with our Development Department. Yeah, so now we have UK Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. I think that's really powerful. because being able to sit your development expertise alongside your national security expertise within your own building under a single minister, I think is a really positive step forward. And you know, projecting that internationally, we've become much more streamlined a post overseas in our overseas network to align all our objectives overseas under one leadership. So I think that is good. I do think this concept of economic security that we're all talking about as well is another big step forward. So that, you know, traditionally the people who worked on trade agreements on an economic diplomacy really sat in a completely different building to those sat working on, you know, national security, state threats and defense. Now, you know, I have a meeting every fortnight on economic security with a range of my counterparts from, you know, trade, development, national security and defense. So I think institutionally, and this all traces back to the Integrated Review, our own national security strategy that was published 2 years ago, which basically put that challenge to us. It said you can no longer separate domestic and international economic and national security. We need to take a much more integrated approach, both in understanding the nature of the problem and in responding to it.
So when you think about that, what does that say about how the cyber portfolio it might evolve or is evolving, might expand, micro? That came up today with this ASEAN meeting, as they said, well, there's cybersecurity and there's data protection and they're slowly merging. So what's the future of the cyber portfolio for you?
Well, anybody who's worked in government, the great danger of any bit of government is silos, right? Mm-hmm. People who sit within their own worlds, put up the walls and just kind of crack on with their objectives without any real awareness of what else is happening.
And the state of nature in government is silos.
At any point, that is dangerous. But particularly in the world we live in today, that is additionally so. And I, you know, I like to talk about cyber diplomacy sitting on a spectrum. And to one end of the spectrum, you kind of have the hard security threats, defense capabilities, hostile states, you know, arms control. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have science and technology, economic development, you know, kind of private partnerships. Yeah. And I think understanding where, as cyber diplomats, where we sit on that spectrum and where we lean at any one point, and there's never a kind of a, there's never a fixed point, right? You've got to range across that spectrum. But I think that's one of the things that makes, I think, cyber policy so interesting is it links to the kind of hard security and to the, you know, the softer development or economic issues.
Are you seeing that among your peers? You know, this was a thing I know we championed and others championed, that you can't just look at this as cybersecurity. You have to look at the human rights aspects, the economic aspects, the governance aspects, because each of these are interdependent. And indeed, some countries who are adversaries don't treat them as independent. They, you know, move in all those spheres. And a lot of these countries are now just grappling with it. Are you seeing that same kind of convergence?
Yeah. So one of the skills of a diplomat is to flex according to the person you're talking to. So I find myself flexing an awful lot, right? So I have a range of kind of discussions with international counterparts. We have formal dialogues. Each of those is structured in a slightly different way because everybody looks at this in a slightly different way. So, you know, with Brazil, I might have a cyber, digital and data partnership, and I'll be talking about data adequacy agreements. And then, you know, with Australia, I might have a cyber and critical tech partnership, and I'll be talking about quantum and an AI, right? So I think it's incumbent on us as diplomats to kind of flex according to who we're talking about. But that means on the UK side, we need to present a much more joined up face. So I need to know enough, but most importantly, be able to pull my colleagues in with greater expertise with me than I, who are on slightly different parts of that spectrum, to talk to my counterparts.
Yeah, we have a quantum podcast, not with Chris, but separately, that is astounding in the number of people who listen to it. We had almost 2,400 on the last broadcast. So you wouldn't think there'd be an audience for quantum, but you know, I think that's one of the things that I've heard from developing countries or the rest of the world. You have 50 people, they're lucky if they have 5.
Yeah.
So how does that work in terms, what do you tell them in terms of overlapping issues and trying to manage this portfolio?
So number one, join up across your own system. That's the first thing we talk about in any discussions around cyber strategy. So, you know, we've been doing this for 13 years now in the UK, and we're pretty comfortable sitting around a table with each other. Everybody knows each other, even as new faces appear. And that kind of sense of collaboration is pretty well established. Doesn't mean that we don't have a few turf wars like any other agency, but on the whole, it works pretty well. But you don't always see that. And that sense of joined up government between national security and economic, between domestic and international, I think is the number one priority. Then after that, it's focusing on your interests, right? Like any organization, what matters most to you at this point? And for most people, that is your economic growth and your national security. So you will come back to those issues. But, we're well aware, right? That's just for us, following the different negotiations. So the OEWG, yeah, the committee, the ITU, plenipotentiary. Those are three big negotiations. What have we got in the 2.5 month period? That's pretty challenging for my team. Now, I sympathize for the one person in the foreign ministry who's trying to cover all three.
So you mentioned this, the multitude of bilateral dialogues you have, which I think there's a cottage industry now. Every country has a bunch of these, so there's a web, which is good. I mean, that's
what diplomats do, right?
But you know, it helps build consensus and issues. But I remember when we did our negotiation in 2015 with China on the theft of intellectual property, we relaunched, or temporarily, didn't last that long, our dialogue with China on cyber issues, which we had had before that. And I remember when the UK had their negotiations with China, they launched a high-level dialogue as well. Yeah. What's the status of that now, and the larger issue of China? You know, we talked a little bit about Russia, but we really haven't talked about China much as, you know, a strategic competitor, as potentially an opponent on some things, as potentially a partner in others. So how is the UK dealing with that? Interestingly, the U.S. doesn't have any, that I know of, Jim, sort of formal dialogue with China. They're still trying to figure that out, as far as I know.
So a senior Chinese diplomat told me a couple weeks before the Ukraine invasion, he said, there's nothing to talk about, which I took as a not a good sign.
Yeah.
But then I think the Chinese were shocked at the Western response to Ukraine. So there's been a few feelers. Do you want to get together and talk? Now, we haven't been able to pull that together. But there is no official dialogue.
Right. There's no track one.
The Chinese are more open than they used to be, but it's still nothing on the plate.
So I think, number one, we think there's plenty to talk about. Number two, we would, of course, want to do that formally with the Chinese government. We had a dialogue in place. Sadly, it got postponed in the wake of the Microsoft Exchange server attribution. But we hope that it can be resurrected. In the meantime, obviously, we continue to talk with the Chinese through the embassy in Beijing, and we hope to do so in New York. I think they're hoping to travel this time for the first time in a while. But it's true, even with those you disagree with, you need to keep talking. And there are, different levels or layers in which you can do that. But I think it's a pretty fundamental element of diplomacy.
Chatham House has a track two with the Chinese. And for a while, everyone wanted their own track two with the Chinese. And they're of mixed utility.
They got plenty of them, I think.
What do you get out of track two? Other than exchange of PowerPoints, which, of course, for me is always fascinating. But
we would much rather talk directly. But where that is difficult, I think track two, track one and a half do have their place. It gives a way to maintain channels of communication. It allows people to talk in a slightly less committed way. It improves understanding. You know, I think it can be complementary, and often it can be a precursor to formal dialogue. So it has its place. It's only really valuable where track one dialogue isn't happening or isn't working. And that itself is suboptimal. I think the Chatham House dialogue is valuable, as is actually the EU-China dialogue, which I joined last year. I thought that was also a kind of a valuable forum.
Ellie Termakar has taken it over.
Right. Yeah, right. There you go. She'll crack it.
Tremendous upgrade. Not a criticism of the previous occupant, but Ellie knows her stuff.
So. Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I agree. Look, you can't be a diplomat and not believe in the importance of talking to people you disagree with, right? So we have to find whatever channels we can to do that.
Certainly my experience is you temper expectations. You know, it's not that that's going to solve all the problems, but you need to have that communication channel for various reasons, as you said. So now switching to one of our other favorite countries, Russia, and Ukraine in particular. There was this narrative when the Ukraine war started, when the invasion started, that cyber wasn't playing that big a role and that cyber was overblown and that, you know, why do we care about cyber? Because it clearly is not the pivotal thing that people have been postulating it is. I know Jim and I have opinions on this, but
that don't match up, I should say.
No, they don't match up, right? I think both of us disagree with that characterization. We agree that the stupid phrase of cyber 9/11 and cyber Pearl Harbor didn't happen, but that never was going to happen.
Yeah. In fact, we have a contest to come up with the next one. So if you've got any, it's the pizza of your choice.
I'll try not to contribute to that arcane debate.
But really, what is your sense of what you're seeing there, what the implications are, you know, outside of the negotiating posture with Russia, but what the implications are for the future of some of the cyber negotiations and diplomacy, given what we've seen in the Ukraine?
So number one, we would absolutely challenge the view that there's no serious cyber conflict. There's a really active cyber conflict. Cyber is not winning or losing the war, but it's absolutely central to the conflict in our view, number one. Number two, obviously it's hidden. Well, I think what we've been most impressed by is the ability of the Ukrainians to respond and react and adapt. And this just underpins for us, you know, I said right at the beginning, obviously part of our objective is to work with Ukraine to ensure Russia loses this war. But at the same time, we are also learning in Ukraine what the Russian approach is, including in cyber conflict. It sort of underlines to us the importance of resilience. Your ability to respond and bounce back from attack is equally important to your ability to resist it in the first place or to be able to project power in response. So this kind of concept of resilience has really been borne out. And the Ukrainian move to the cloud and their work with private sector organizations to patch and repair, I think has been really impressive. And we've put quite a lot of assistance in directly to help them do that. So that's been a real learning experience. The other thing is the Russians are adapting. Frankly, at the beginning, our view was the Russian coordination, the Russian integration of its capabilities was pretty chaotic. Hmm. But equally, we recognize the Russians also learn and they're adapting and trying new things. But this conflict is absolutely ongoing, whether it is trying to attack CNI or it is fusing cyber capabilities alongside kind of traditional kinetic operations, whether that is strikes on institutions or individuals. So I think, you know, when the history of the cyber conflict in Ukraine is written, it will be much more extensive than we have seen. And it would be really surprising if we were seeing all of it now. That's not to say that cyber will win or lose the war. Clearly, still, you know, traditional military, political, economic capabilities are most powerful. But there's no doubt that cyber capabilities are an important component of those.
We're coming close to the end of our time. So maybe my final question will touch on that, because one of the debates we're still having here is on where offensive cyber capabilities fit into both our diplomatic strategy and to our military strategies. And that will be something that perhaps over time will grow more important as more countries acquire these capabilities. So. What can you say as a serving British official, what can you say about offensive cyber capabilities and your views on it, where it fits in? And the UK has been a leader, by the way, in transparency. So,
yeah, so I think that's one of the key points I'd make is we avowed the National Cyber Force. We said we were developing an offensive cyber capability because we believe it's a central requirement of an effective national defense capability. But at the same time, within our national cyber strategy, we talked about the development of responsible cyber power. So we should apply constraints on how we use this. We already do. You know, there's certain things that we wouldn't do. We are already constrained by international law. We're already constrained by domestic law, by independent oversight. And so we do believe in greater transparency and, I guess, rules of responsible use of cyber capabilities, including offensive cyber. And it's one of the reasons I think we've been more transparent than others about how we use these capabilities. I think that, you know, conversation will continue. I think our view is you cannot stop countries developing these capabilities.
Yeah.
What you have to do is establish norms and rules of responsible use of those capabilities. That is probably the most effective way to go about it. And you do that by your own behavior, but also about kind of formalizing that in agreements with your like-minded and with others. And that, you know, that takes us back to the multilateral negotiations we were talking about earlier.
This goes back a little bit to the war in Ukraine too, is that, you know, some have said, well, you know, we have these rules. If these are being violated willy-nilly, it goes back to how do you change that? And I think that's some of your early answers. And I think, interestingly, in the British system, as I understand it, a lot of these issues, the offensive issues, also comes up through the foreign minister, which is a very different from our system, and it helps integrate those things. But I guess it's my last question. It goes back to one of the early things you talked about, the growth of cyber diplomacy, the more prominence of cyber diplomacy. You know, all three of us, and Jim and I in particular, have been around the block a bunch of times, more than we should count. And we've seen cyber go up and down, sort of like a sinusoidal wave, where it gets really popular and then people forget about it when the next bright, shiny object comes along. Are we at a place now where we're going to have sustained attention on this, or are you worried about that kind of slipping away when the crisis is sort of ebb in the next couple of years, hopefully?
I mean, I think there's a risk. I recognize the risk, right, Chris? There's always the next, the current crisis or the next shiny thing. But I think the arguments for the importance of cybersecurity, cyber diplomacy, cyber capabilities are really strong. Right. The basic argument that you cannot take advantage of new technologies without confidence in the security and integrity of your networks, and that unless you invest in that cybersecurity, in those cyber skills, in those cyber capabilities, then you're going to remain vulnerable and you're not going to be able to exploit that advantage. That's a pretty powerful argument. And I think obviously we need to continue to make that. But I think it does require a bunch of non-experts to make that argument. We need to present this in a way that resonates with politicians and policymakers for whom cybersecurity is at the moment a slightly remote and complicated concept. Yeah. And so that's part of my theme, right, is to bring in more non-experts into this field, and particularly in cyber diplomacy. It's a kind of space where you can do that, bring more non-experts in order to, you know, explain that in ways that resonate with a different audience. And I think that sort of mantra of demystify and diversify is the kind of thing we should all hold to, right? If we are going to, as you say, continue to keep this issue at the top of the agenda, you need to make it accessible to a broader set of policymakers.
I mean, obviously, we could have gone for even another hour on some of these issues. So really, thank you for your time.